Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we're sponsored by the Dallas Comedy Festival. Now, the deadline to submit for the 7th annual Dallas Comedy Festival is fast approaching. So if you're a stand-up, an improv team, or a sketch troupe, visit DallasComedyFestival.com and submit before December 10th to be a part of this year's bigger and better festival. The festival takes place March 23rd through the 26th in warm and sunny Dallas, Texas. All you need to do is visit DallasComedyFestival.com for more information. We're also sponsored by Ad Lib Theater in Winter Park, Florida, and they're expanding the frontiers of improv by producing shows, creating opportunities for performers, and working with the community to provide alternative comedy outlets in Central Florida. Their training program is dedicated to long-form improv, and their core program focuses on the legendary form, The Herald. Ad Lib Theater creates a supportive community and lives up to their slogan, where you fill in the blanks. To find out more, please visit them at adlibcomedy.com. That's adlibcomedy.com. Also, don't forget to check out my award-winning improv classes and workshops here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy. Chicago Magazine recently said I was one of the 5 people to study comedy with in the city of Chicago. For more information about my classes and workshops, all you need to do is go to my slick new website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. And don't forget to check out my new book, The Inner Game of Improv, 5 Steps to Getting a Bigger Career in Improv. It's a really short read. It's only 70 pages. It's $3.99, and it's a great book if you want to get an even bigger career in improv. You can go to Amazon and get it as an ebook, or you can go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and download it as a PDF. Okay, we got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you, but when do we not have a great episode of Improv Nerd? I can't even think about the last time we had a bad episode of Improv Nerd. I think they don't exist, actually. We can discuss that later. Let's get to this episode. We have a great guest today. He is the artistic director of the SAC Comedy Lab in Orlando, Florida. He's been the artistic director since 2006. Before moving to Florida, he was at the I.O. Chicago, where he studied, and he was also on the legendary Herald team Revolver. In college, he was part of Mission Improvable. Besides improvising and teaching at the SAC Comedy Lab, he also works at Disney World at the Monsters, Inc. Laugh Floor, which he actually improvises as some of the characters. We talked to Mike about how he developed an interest in theater and how it took priority over baseball and even the prom. What it was like to perform with Mission Improvable in front of college audiences and what it's like to be an artistic director in an improv theater. This episode was recorded live at the Tampa Improv Festival in Tampa, Florida, and I want to thank Nicholas Riggs for putting that all together. I just want to say that here in the States, it's the beginning of the Christmas season or the holiday season, and typically that is a time where I get super depressed. It's a combination of the time of the year. Christmas is traditionally, for me, is always a time where I feel down, never really good about myself. I have a tendency to compare myself to other people and what I've accomplished. And then it never lives up to its expectations. Also, Christmas in my house growing up was very stressful. And then here in Chicago, the weather gets really, there's not much sunlight. So you've kind of got the holiday blues with seasonal affect disorder, which does not make a very good combination. But I do feel good because Lauren and I yesterday, what we call Black Friday here, which is supposed to be a big shopping day, but apparently, well, it's bigger than I thought. We went to the mall later in the day, around dinner time, because I figured a lot of people would not have been there, but I was totally wrong. There was a lot of people there, and she wanted to get a couple pair of jeans for herself, and then we started to buy some gifts, one for her uncle, some CDs, and we went to Barnes & Noble, a big bookstore. And apparently CDs and DVDs, I'm probably the last to know, but they're not as popular for some whatever reason. And so there's not as big of a selection anymore of DVDs and CDs, but we did get her uncle a couple CDs, and then we got our nephew a gift, and then we got my brother-in-law, who wanted sweatpants. We got him some sweatpants, so I hope he's not listening. But I feel good about that, because we got a good jump start on the Christmas shopping, because the whole thing about giving gifts can depress me as well. But you did not tune in to hear about my woes and about my Christmas shopping. You tuned in to hear about improv. And here it is. You're going to enjoy it. All the way from Tampa, Florida, the Tampa Improv Festival, the Mike Carr episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
What do you think about how close people are?
It was a little disarming at first, because I didn't see her right away. I looked this way, and I was like, oh, it's a nice room, make way. Oh, hello, you're on stage. So it was a little surprising, but it was fun.
Because it's packed in here.
It's great, yeah.
All right, so I must feel like, you know what I'm going to do, Mike? Let's move even closer.
All right.
There's
a little spill here.
We have a spill?
Yep, all right. All right. Here, take that one.
What a great staff. They've already cleaned it
that
up.
That was so fast.
They didn't have to say anything.
So
they didn't have to say anything.
It's like a ball boy at Wimbledon.
It looks like a...
It looks
like
you have a friend who shits his pants. And
right.
Like,
all right.
That is creeping towards this poor young lady. Like, she's watching it very carefully.
No, I don't think putting your hand up is going to stop. But it's a really good idea. All right, so you grew up in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Small town outside of Boston.
Yeah, just outside of Boston.
And you said your mother inspired you in pursuing acting.
Yes.
How did she do that?
As a kid, my mother would take my sisters and I to see live theater all the time. So we would, especially during the summer, there was a lot of just community theater groups and groups that would travel and perform at libraries and such. So we would go watch theater, and I remember one show particularly seeing Jesus Christ Superstar at the Somerville Library. And
How was the production?
As an 8-year-old, I was underwhelmed. No, it was an outdoor production, and it was at night, so they just had floodlights to do the stage. And, you know, it wasn't the greatest production, it was a community theater production, but I particularly remember the whipping scene when Jesus is getting whipped. And the guy who was playing Jesus, they tied him up like this, and
on a cross.
Not yet. Yeah, that's later. he was just they tied his hands up like with pulleys, so he just had his hands suspended. It looked like the cross, but it wasn't the cross yet. And the guy whipping him didn't actually have a whip; he just had a stick, and there was no actual whip to it. So he was behind him, just going like swinging as hard as he could, and the actor playing Jesus was just really into it. And I remember watching that, just going, wow, like, they're really into this. This is fun. Like, I got into theater by seeing Jesus get whipped and going, that looks fun.
So you got really serious. Like, in middle school, you were in drama club, and you did Kids Stock Summer Theater.
Yeah, it was a summer theater program called Kids Stock Summer Theater Education Center was the full name. And I started that when I was a freshman in high school. In junior high, we had a theater group, we had a theater club that met once a week, and we did three plays, one a year. So in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, we did plays that were fun. But it was when I did Kidstock that I started to really get more serious about acting and being on stage.
And you were supposed to improv it, right? The first time?
Yeah, that's where I first did improv. It was, every summer had four different plays. So it would be 1 month, you would rehearse a play for 3 weeks, then perform it on a weekend. Same thing for each month. And it usually ended in a musical. The first year we did Grease, which was awesome.
What was awesome about it?
I got to play Danny Zuko, which is the lead in Grease, so it felt super cool. And I beat out a guy who couldn't stop talking about how he was going to go to NYU. He was a junior in high school. He was like, I'm going to go to NYU for theater. And I was like, that's great, I'm 14. But I got the part of Danny, and he didn't, and he was pissed about it. Like, I remember he was really mad because he wanted to be that part. So he got Kanicki, But we didn't do Grease Lightning because it's too dirty for 14-year-olds to sing. So I got that part, and it made me feel good. I'm like, oh, I can actually do this. You know, and I'm not a singer, per se. I can sing, but I'm not a trained singer. So to be able to get that part was like, oh, cool. Like, this is realistic for me, I think.
And you were, really serious in high school about theater.
Yes.
There was a time where something happened at junior prom.
Oh, yeah. So there was a community theater that I joined, and I did they did two shows a year, so I would do the shows with them. And in my junior year, they were doing a play called Kiss Me, Kate, which was a musical based on The Taming of the Shrew. And I auditioned. There's two roles called The Gangsters. And The Gangsters are, they don't really sing. They do a actor song, kind of patter song, without having to sing too hard. And it was one of the fun roles of the play. So I didn't know if I'd get it, because I was only 16 when I auditioned, and I was auditioning with adults who actually looked like they could conceivably be gangsters, whereas I hadn't shaved yet, so I was just like, oh, I'm a tough guy. But I was tall, so it worked. But I got the part, and my junior prom fell on one of the show nights, and I remember my mother was like, well, your junior prom's pretty important. Do you want to do your junior prom, or do you want to do the play? And I was like, I'm doing the play. I'll go to junior prom late. I don't care. So I asked a girl to go to junior prom with me, and she was like, yeah. I said, but here's the thing. I'm in a play that night, and it won't get over till like 10 or 10:30, and the prom ends at 11:30. Do you mind just going for an hour? And she was like, oh, okay. She was cool with it. But we ended up having a good time because we stormed in at the very end. Like, I threw the suit on in the car and was like, let's go. So it was fun. But I'd rather do theater. That was more fun for me.
Well, and also when you were on the baseball team with a championship game.
I walked away.
Yeah. Right
before the last out. It sounds very dramatic. I walked away. It was freshman year, and we were doing My Fair Lady. I'm glad you laughed at that. We were doing My Fair Lady, and we had one of our tech rehearsals. And my baseball team was in the championship game of the season. So if we won, we'd win the championship. So I believe it was the sixth or seventh inning, because I think we didn't play nine innings yet. We only played seven innings. And our team was up by a couple runs, so I knew we were going to win, and I had to start rehearsal. So I said to my coach, like, hey,
here you are in your baseball
uniform. I'm in full baseball uniform. And I said, hey, I have to go to rehearsal. And he's like, we're about to win the title. And I'm like, yeah, all right. I got to go to rehearsal. And he was just like, okay, well, have fun. And I said, okay, bye. Good job, guys. And I left. The dugout and ran to the theater.
Did you take shit for that later?
No, not really, because I didn't hang out with those guys. I was doing theater, and they were still playing baseball.
What were you doing on the baseball team then?
Oh, I loved playing baseball. Okay. I loved playing baseball, but that was the time where I realized I'd rather be doing performance. That was more, it made me happier. And also, I wasn't a great baseball player. I was decent. I got on the freshman team. I don't think I would have gone much farther, honestly. At the time, I thought I would have, but now looking back, I realize I wasn't great. But I had a choice. It was, you can go do theater, or you can still try to do this, and I just felt like theater was more of a calling for me, so I went that way.
And then you go to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
Yes.
And you're studying theater there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exposed to an improv troupe called Mission Improbable.
Yes.
Known for their short form.
Yeah, known for their short form.
Touring colleges and stuff like that. How did you get involved with them?
I saw them on the first night of college. They have a big freshman orientation all across the campus. And I saw a poster as I was walking through the campus with a friend of mine for an improv show. And I'd only done it once before back in that high school group that I was in. And we didn't do much of it, but I really liked it. So I went to the show and watched it and really just was very impressed with it. They played rock music at the beginning. They came out, they had matching t-shirts, which is a staple of improv, which is totally awesome. I still have my t-shirt from that group. But it just looked so cool. And they were so funny, but they were also good performers and good actors. Like, and that was the first time I think I had seen improv also in the same light as acting. Like, they are so similar. So I wanted to be a part of it, so I talked to them after, and they're like, oh, we have auditions every semester. So I went to the auditions, and I didn't get in my first.
So when you don't get in, how are you feeling about it?
I was pretty dejected. You know, I wasn't ruined because I knew I hadn't done a lot of improv. I knew that I was just kind of wandering off the street. And the people, I remember being in the audition, and there were so many guys that were so good that I was just completely in awe of. One guy in particular, this guy Matt, was we were talking about pro wrestling before the audition because we were both fans of it. And at one point, tip of the cup from that guy, we were talking about it, and then in one of the scenes, he made a comment about The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and he looked at me, and I didn't say anything back because I was kind of insecure about it. I was like, just kind of stood there. And then after the scene, he goes, "Why didn't you say anything back to me?" I was like, I didn't know what to say. And I got nervous. Like, I didn't know what he wanted. So I kind of was timid. I was a little timid at that point. Even when someone invited me into a moment, I was just like, I'm not ready for that yet. So
eventually you do make audition improv.
Yeah, they had an audition the next semester. And after my audition, the director said, "Oh, come back and audition." And I went and watched shows because I found that was, I really liked it. I just loved watching improv. And I was still doing theater and doing plays in the theater department at UMass, but improv was kind of like...
What did you like about doing improv versus doing scripted theater stuff?
I liked the immediacy of it. The scripted stuff I did, that the first semester I did was a one-act play called Our Man in Madras. And it was...
Oh, I love it. It's a classic.
It's a classic. It's a classic. Olivier did it beautifully. it was just a one-man show, and I love plays. I love acting, but the director was very adamant on, this is how you feel in this moment, this is how you respond, this is how you should be, because that's what the script calls for. But when something would happen and I would do something differently because I was just kind of trying to react, I would be told, "Oh no, you're supposed to be angry there." I said, "Okay, but that something happened that was funny." So I would laugh and I would be told not to. There was one show where in the play I sit down in a chair and I put my feet on the desk, and I must have leaned back too far because I fell over on stage in front of the audience and hit the ground, and I got up and my character's on the phone, so I just quickly made up a quick little monologue blaming the guy on the phone for me falling over, and got back on the script and continued, and afterwards I got chastised for that moment. Like, well, that's not in the script, and you weren't supposed to do it. Stick to the script. And I was thinking, but everyone saw me fall. If I pretended I didn't fall, that's not being genuine. That's lying, in a way. But when I would see the improv shows, they would do great scenes and great stories and characters, but if something happened, they incorporated it and they made it part of what they did. And I was so enamored with that. I thought that was so cool.
Now, I never had the experience of performing for colleges. You know, being in college, because it was improv had not... In terms of college, you know, I'm old and you're way younger than I am. What was that like?
It was fun. I came into the group, and the group had an established following because the original guys who started it, they ended up moving to Chicago and they started their own group, and then they started touring the country. But they had built this regular show every Saturday at 8 o'clock, and they had built up a following over their 4 years.
How many people would show up?
In between 150 and 200.
And you would do that every week?
Yeah, it would vary. Like, sometimes it would be less, but like most of the time we had well over 100 people.
And what was that like?
It was like a rock and roll show. Because we had, you know, we were in a campus center room, we weren't in a theater, we were in a room, and we'd set the chairs up, and you know, our lighting was literally fluorescent lights that would go on and off, and we had a boombox set up with a couple bigger speakers. But you know, we played rock and roll music, and you know, we came out to Back in Black by AC/DC, and you know, that's awesome. And we had stage names too, so it just felt like this.
Stage names? Wait. You didn't go by My Car?
No, I didn't.
What'd you go by?
I initially was Waldo. That was not my choice. You get named by the group. That was a big thing about Mission Improv, was you would get named for your stage name. So if someone called me Waldo, because my first semester I was doing that play, so I was never there. So they're like, "Hey, where's Mike?" So it became Where's Waldo. Was where the name came from.
Now, were you guys considered cool?
To a certain core of people, yes. The people that came and see our shows consistently really liked us. We would get stopped on campus if they recognized us, and they'd say, "Oh, I saw your show, it was really funny." One guy came over to my friend Sean and I while we were eating lunch one day and just stood there and didn't say anything for a couple minutes, and then finally goes, "I really like you guys." We're like, "Oh, thanks, man." And he goes, "You should be on Saturday Night Live." And I said, "Yeah, oh, thanks." And then he just stood there for another minute, kind of awkwardly. We just kept eating, and then he finally walked away. But the people that liked us really liked us. And the people that didn't like us didn't know what we did, because it was a UMass is a school at the time that was 45,000 students, so not everybody knows what's going on. I do want to say this, though. My name, after I wasn't Waldo, I got the name Bulldog, which is much better than Waldo.
Why Bulldog?
The aforementioned wrestling guy, Matt was his name, he just looked at me one day and he said, Waldo, your name's Bulldog. And that was it. And that was it.
So then you pack up, five people from college go to Chicago, right?
Yeah, we were all in the same
group. How did you decide to do that?
Well, we thankfully, during our time at Mission Improbable, the guys who started the group would come back to UMass because they were touring colleges. So they would be in Rhode Island or they'd be in Connecticut or New Hampshire, and they'd call us and say, we're going to come through Massachusetts. We're going to stop by for the weekend because we have a couple days off. So they would come by and do workshops with us, and then they would do shows with us. And they would tell us, you know, oh, we're in Chicago, and our coaches, their coach was Liz Allen, and they would share exercises that she taught. They would share things they learned at I.O., and we were so lucky to get that kind of extra training. So we decided in our senior year to take our spring break and go to Chicago. So we got in a van. There was 15 of us in a 15-passenger van, and we drove all night to Chicago. And one of our friends had already moved there the year before, and we all crashed on his floor. All 15 of us.
In like an apartment?
Yeah, it was a very small apartment on Southport across from the Music Box Theater. So it was a great area. Like, it was really cool. And that was the first sight we saw when we stepped out of the van was this this Music Box Theater is this beautiful theater.
It's an old theater.
Yeah. Great big marquee. And that's the first thing we saw. And we're like, wow, that's just beautiful. And then the next morning we get up and we walk to McDonald's because that's what you eat in college. And the McDonald's is right next to Wrigley Field, which was another sight to be seen.
We were like in the Emerald City.
That's it was amazing. Yeah, it was
like,
incredible.
It doesn't get any better
than
that.
Yeah, it's like, and Wrigley Field, if you've been there, it's literally like you don't see it coming. You're just walking down the street, and all of a sudden, there's one of the most iconic baseball fields in America, and it's just right there. So we for that week of spring training, we saw shows, we did workshops, and I think it was the second or third day, we just said, yeah, we got to come here, and we got to keep doing this. Because it was just so fun.
So you moved to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And all five of you get one apartment?
Yeah, there was five of us.
What was that like?
Terrible.
How many bedrooms was it?
We had four bedrooms. One of them was, there was a couple.
Okay. Not a good idea or a good idea?
The couple? That couple wasn't a good idea.
Okay, why wasn't it a good idea?
They weren't right for each other, and okay. They moved to Chicago. That's a long story.
I'm saying, to move in with a couple, was that a good idea?
Oh, that's not a problem. Okay, I was fine with that.
You know this is a very, you know, educational podcast, so
yes,
I just pass that
I want to make sure that anyone that's thinking of moving to Chicago, if you're going to live with a couple, you know, do pre-interviews with both of them, make sure that they're not going to freak out.
A credit check? Yes.
Oh, definitely do a credit check.
Okay, good.
I say horrible, and I should. No, it was just what didn't work outweighed what worked. There were three of us were so close to each other because we were doing improv. Unfortunately, a couple of the other roommates didn't get jobs right away, so it was a little tough for them. And I still love those people. Like, it's not like I don't like those people. They're great friends, but living together wasn't maybe the best choice. One of them was a friend of mine from home, and he wasn't an improviser, so he was just kind of, I felt like he was a little bit of fish out of water with all of us in such close quarters. You know, you get on each other's nerves easily. So when we decided after that year to live apart, it was like, we're going to break into smaller groups. So.
And so you get involved at I.O.
Yes.
Start taking classes at
I.O. Yeah, took classes at I.O.
Yep,
started taking classes and was so happy. Just, I loved taking classes. I loved getting that. Just that incredible education. And I was lucky, the people that I had as teachers were just amazing.
And you said Jason Chin, who passed away mm-hmm. last year,
yeah.
Was a huge influence. What was it about?
He was my level one and my level four teacher, and then I had him later for another project. He cut through the bullshit. Like, he didn't sugarcoat anything. He knew his opinion, he knew what he wanted to get across, and he knew how to help you understand it. In our level one class, one of our first classes, we did a game where, I think it's called Cocktail Party, where you sit in a pair and you face each other and you just talk about what you know about. And you pick a topic that you know a lot about, and that's what you talk about when he calls your number. And he called the number for these two guys that were sitting there, and one of them started talking about going out and hitting on bitches. And that's how he phrased it. And Jason just stopped it right there. And he's like, nope, that's not acceptable. And put a stop to it right away and gave him three reasons why he shouldn't be doing it. Number one, it's disrespectful to the women in the room. Number two, you're trying to be funny. You're not listening to anybody. And number three, he was like, you obviously, he made a joke. He said, you obviously don't know about that. Or, you know, he just hit him really quick and just didn't make him feel bad, but he was very clear. He's like, what you're doing, these are the reasons why you're doing is wrong. And he was just so aware of the class and just giving of his time and his knowledge. So it was so wonderful to have him as a teacher.
So you're there for about a year. You get on a team. You get on your first team, they put you on, you get cut.
Yeah, our team gets cut.
How was that?
That sucked. That was really hard.
What was hard about it?
I blamed myself for our team getting cut for a long time.
What were you saying? What was the reason? Why was it your fault?
Well, we only had three shows on the schedule.
Okay.
So our third show, I was at work. I worked in a warehouse during the day. So I was at work, and something went wrong at work, so I had to do someone else's job, which I had never done before. And it stressed me out, like, because I didn't know how to do it. And I'll try to explain it to see if you... We worked in a warehouse. It was an industrial supply warehouse. So we sold products that everybody... companies needed, individuals, and we had a what is called the bin structure, where it's all small things like screws and washers and anything small that people might buy from a warehouse, like a giant Amazon warehouse, essentially. And my job was to send these little plastic totes up to certain areas so they could fill their orders and send them down a long conveyor belt. I'd never done it before, so I was way behind. No, their orders were piling up. People were mad at me because I was the guy that was supposed to be giving them things. And I ended up staying 45 minutes late to try to fix the problem. And I was just totally stressed out. So I finally get out, and I'm like, I have a show. So I get to the theater, and I tell my team, like, I'm just not, I don't feel good. I'm a little mad. Sorry, guys. So in the show, I just felt like I didn't do anything because I was so mad. I carried it all with me on stage. Every ounce of anger I had at my job was with me on stage. So when the show was over, and we went backstage, and we talked about it, and our coach was like, it wasn't bad. And I was like, I suck. I'm sorry, guys. It was terrible. And then 3 days later, we get the email from our coach saying, you're cut.
And you thought it was your fault?
I took it on myself. I was like, that was me. I was so mad.
Do you do that in life?
I do, yes. I definitely will blame myself for a lot of things. My girlfriend is laughing right now.
She's laughing at his show. What kind of stuff does he take on? That he shouldn't be taking on. That isn't his...
Oh, everything. I mean, if the mailman has a bad day,
If the mail doesn't come on time, it's your fault?
He's just so...
That's an extreme example. I think that, you know, for me at that time, for that team, I felt like I should have been better, because if I was better, we would have had a better show. If we had a better show, we wouldn't have been better.
Now, how responsible do you feel for this show right now?
Very. Okay. To a degree, because, you know, I'm the subject of the interview, so I feel like I have a lot to carry. Mm-hmm. But I'm not alone. I'm here. You're here with me, so
right.
I feel safe.
Okay. So then, you're established in Chicago. You got on a team, a great team called Revolver.
Yes.
And after a year, you make a really hard decision. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, to go back, for Revolver, after I got cut, like I said, I blamed myself, and I got...
How'd you get over that, by the way?
Actually, getting back, doing a class with Bill Arnett, doing it was a four-week Herald class. Doing that kind of helped me get my legs back under me. And then getting on Revolver actually got that away. And that was thanks to the coach, Mike Enriquez. Who unfortunately also passed away just a few years ago. Mike was the coach of both of my teams. So I was bitter when I got cut, and I had that chip on your shoulder. You know, like I felt like I deserved to be there. And
it's hard for me to imagine you being bitter.
I didn't. It was a different time.
Your bitter last like a week?
It lasted a few months.
Okay.
Because I was off the team for several months.
And what does bitter look like for you?
It looks pretty much like this, except I internalize a lot.
Okay.
My shoulders might be hunched a little more.
Right.
And I think I had about 40 more pounds on it.
Right, and you're not returning the phone calls as quickly as you usually do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, I wouldn't. My chip on my shoulder didn't really manifest until I was in rehearsals with Revolver. And my coach saw it, and he called it.
What did he say?
He said, you're improvising angrily, and you shouldn't be. And
no, I'm not.
Yeah, shut up, Mike Enriquez.
Right. They should never have cut my teeth.
Those bastards.
Right.
Herald Commission.
Yeah.
But he saw it and he said to me, you know, you're improvising angrily. Like, I can see it. And he's like, you don't need to do that. You're here. Be where you are and be happy with where you are. Yes, you got cut, but you're back. So being angry doesn't help anything, and it doesn't help your teammates. And it was one of those kind of wake-up calls, you know. I said, yeah, I don't have to be angry. And I'm angry about something that was arbitrary. I'm angry about something that doesn't mean I'm not valid. It doesn't mean I'm not good. It was a numbers game, and my number got called. And that's what I had to come to realize. And being a part of Revolver really helped me with that. Because I ended up going to the Herald auditions. They had an audition for the teams and got placed on Revolver with a few other people, one of which was my roommate at the time, this guy, Rob.
Rob White.
Yes, Rob White. We were placed on the team together, so it was nice to have someone I knew there, but it was also half out of the classes. So it was an interesting dichotomy, because these guys all knew each other coming out of classes, and then the four or five of us that were not from classes, not all knew each other. I knew Rob, and I had seen the other people on the team tangentially. But so now we had this whole new thing to create, and thankfully it gelled right away. And those early Revolver rehearsals and shows kind of got me back into a place where I was happy with myself and knowing that I'm in a good spot. And it was an amazing team. I mean, they're still around. They just celebrated 10 years. So it's...
And so you decide after a year, mm-hmm. and Revolver is like 10, you know, they've got a great reputation.
Yeah.
I mean, you decide their auditions for Disney.
Yes. In 2006, it was like March of 2006, I went to an audition for Disney. They used to tour and do auditions for their improv comedy club that was called the Comedy Warehouse. And I was interested in going there. I did something called the Walt Disney World College Program when I was in college, and I spent a semester working in Disney, and I enjoyed it. I never had a plan to go back to Florida. That was never in my plan. So went to the audition, and they called me back, and they kept keeping me, but not for the Comedy Warehouse, which was a short-form improv theater. It was for another show. They were like, oh, we have this other thing that we're interested in, improv actors, so would you mind sticking around? And I stuck around all day and did a few voices for them and did some improv scenes.
What kind of voices?
The voices I did, they asked me to do two voices as if they were having a conversation. So I was doing two characters at once. And one of them, I don't remember exactly, I remember one of them, and it's really annoying. So I'm going to do it right now.
Okay, please.
This is what it sounded like.
It was really annoying, but I sustained that for like a 5-minute conversation with a different voice. I don't remember what it was, but they had a conversation about talking to a girl at a nearby table. I remember that from the audition. And the director's like, oh, that was great. Would you be interested in relocating if we were to offer you something? And I just said, yeah, sure, why not? Not thinking that anything was coming my way, but, you know, if a job offer comes, it's worth exploring. So 6 months go by, and I'm working at my warehouse again, and I'm leaving, and I check my phone when I get to my car, and there's a voicemail from a 407 number, which is the Orlando area code. I didn't know that at the time, and it was Walt Disney World offering me a full-time contract for a brand new show. And I was like, oh, okay. And I called them back, and we started talking. Like, it would require you to move down here. It's a 15-month contract, and it would be, you know, you'd be basically opening this brand new show.
Do you remember how much they were going to pay you the first?
I do. $15 an hour was
okay.
There, and it was a 40-hour contract.
Okay.
So that would be what it was to start. At the warehouse I was working at, I was making a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. So when I called them back, and I didn't call them back. I called them back first, talked to them. Then I was home for a weekend. I talked to my mom and dad about it.
What'd they say?
They were gung-ho. They were like, you got to do it.
Right.
Because one thing I'd always said as a kid is, I want to be a working actor. Like, whatever that means. Like, that means I want to be able to make my living as a performer. Mm-hmm. And this was that opportunity being presented. And it was just a short-term contract. 15 months sounds like a lot, but it went by real quick.
Was your plan that I'm going to do it for 15 months and come back to Chicago?
Yeah, that was my plan. I figured I'd go down, get some experience, and then bring it back, go back to Chicago, because that's kind of what I thought I would end up doing. But after I got to Orlando, I ended up taking the contract and saying goodbye to Revolver, and it was hard. But
what was hard about it?
Because we were a good team, and we were just starting to get to that next echelon of Herald teams. Like, we were the opening team for a while, then we started being the second team, and on our final night, the team that was supposed to close ended up switching with us. so we could close, so I could make it to the show. And it was Halloween night in 2006. So the fact that the other team was willing to do that for us, and that their coach talked to our coach and was like, yeah, this is a team that deserves
it. Plus, there was other things in Chicago that you wanted to explore, right?
Yeah, I wanted to explore the Annoyance. I wanted to explore Second City and take the classes and maybe someday perform at those places. And that was another reason I thought, when this is over, I'll just go back, you know, because those are going to be there. So it was, the decision was not easy, but it was, I think it was the right decision. I still feel that way, because it was an opportunity to grow in a way that wouldn't be presented otherwise. And then 15 months came and went, and I stayed because I found SAC Comedy Lab, the improv theater that I'm currently the artistic director at. My director at Disney was also the director of that company, and of the show that I did. And he said, oh, you're an improviser, you know, why don't you come to the theater and check it out? So I went one night and jumped in a show, and it was different because it was a short-form show, and I had been doing long-form for 3 years.
Now, were you a long-form snob like I was?
For a little while.
Okay, great.
For a little while. I had to get over that, because then I realized that they're not as different as people think they are, at least when you get down to just playing scenes. So I finally, you know, went to the theater, did a show, and had fun, and then started playing regularly with them, and ended up just meeting a great group of people that were very interested in long form and Chicago style improv, and I was able to kind of bring some of the stuff that I had learned to Orlando and share that with them. We started doing a long form show there, and they'd had similar long form shows in the past, but this was a brand new kind of show. So we were trying to infuse that long form mentality into the short form world of SAC.
And now we are going to do something. We're going to improvise now.
Yes.
Something that you guys do in your short form show at SAC.
Yes.
Can you just explain what we're going to do?
Sure. We do a game called Chairs. Okay. You and I are going to walk around this space holding our chairs.
Holding our chairs.
Yeah, we'll hold them. And then someone in the audience will pick someone that will just yell stop at some point.
Okay.
And when they yell stop, we just put our chairs down, and then we start a scene based on that position. So that will be whatever inspires us to start.
Okay, so I'm a little confused here.
Okay.
What's the whole idea of holding the chairs? How is that going to inspire us?
It's just, we're just holding them and walking around. So it's, we can hold it up above our head, we can lean it against the wall. You just carry the chair, and when they say stop, wherever the chair is, you can choose to put it down or just hold it wherever it is and let that be whatever starts the scene.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's
it. So it's based on space?
Yeah, based on space, based on... Yeah, it's really just based on space and position.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great. So we probably need a little more room, right?
I think so.
Okay, so Nick getting the waters out.
Wimbledon. Cool. Let's see. Would you mind yelling stop at some point?
You bet.
Okay. Great.
And do me a favor. Why don't you hold this? Can you just hold this out, like there, as we do the improv here? Get a little better sound. Okay. If your arm gets tired, just switch your hand.
So we're holding these chairs, and we're just kind of moving around.
Okay, great. We're moving around with the chairs.
You don't have to be afraid of me.
I'm not afraid of you.
Are you sure?
Positive.
Okay. I'm not a violent criminal. A lot of people think I am, but I'm not.
I read your records. I killed somebody once. I thought about killing somebody. I didn't actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
Call you Jeremiah.
You may.
Pardon?
You may call me Jeremiah.
Okay. Cool. I'm down with that. So I went over your file.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of history about what you did. I just need to get some questions if you want me to represent you.
Sure. If you got the questions, I can answer them.
Okay. Well,
is this water free?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Great. Nothing's free back there.
No, I know. It's prison. We actually pay for that with our tax dollars.
Taxes?
Taxes, yeah.
Never paid those.
I know. So when you make a certain amount of money, then the government wants some, and then they give it to schools, and they give it to prisons, and they give it to other things.
The wall's going to hold itself up.
I know, I understand that. I actually have a pain in my arm.
What part of your arm?
It's in my triceps.
Oh.
Yeah. No, well, you don't. I'm fine. I'm cool.
Are you sure?
I'm cool. Yeah. You know what? It actually is starting to get loose now.
Well, if it hurts again, let me know.
Sure. I will. If I'm going to represent you, you've got to be 100% honest with me.
I will be 100% honest with you, but you need to be 100% honest with me.
I lied about the thing. I'm terrified. You're a really big guy. With a history of murder. Okay?
I'm not going to murder you. I'm willing to promise you that.
Great. And we don't have to shake on it. It's an oral agreement. Okay.
Is your tricep still bothering you?
No.
Are you? Honesty?
I'm totally honest with you.
Okay.
Because
if you want me to rub your tricep, I will.
No, I'm cool. I'm down with it.
All right.
Okay.
You're down with it?
I'm just using
down with it means you want it.
Okay. I'm using that language just so you feel comfortable with me. I don't know what I'm saying.
Fair enough.
Now, I'm going to go. The night of October 12th, 2014. Did you go over to Carol Belton's house, your girlfriend at the time?
I did. However, I wouldn't define her as my girlfriend.
Okay.
We were hooking up, but we weren't like a thing. I don't like labels.
Okay. That evening, did you have an argument with Carol over a dinner reservation?
Yes.
Did that conversation escalate to a fight?
It kind of started as a fight. Then it de-escalated to conversation. Then re-escalated to argument. We had a momentary ceasefire.
Okay. Anywhere in the conversation, escalation, back to escalation, did you ever put your hands around her neck? Take your time answering.
Thank you. Define the neck.
The part between the chin and the chest.
Yes, I did put my hands around her neck.
Okay.
However, I did not squeeze. Have you ever hugged someone?
Yes.
That's what it was. Just a hug.
A hug around the neck?
Yeah. Have you ever heard that song?
No, I haven't.
I love you, a bush and a peck, a bush and a peck, and a
hug around the neck.
I'm willing to sing that in court.
That's fine. evidence.
Evidence of a hug.
Could be. Could be.
Good. We're getting somewhere.
Yes. When the hug was over. Did you cut off her breathing in any way to cause her to suffocate?
That sounds like a gotcha question.
Okay, I'll rephrase it.
Please do.
Did you kill her?
If I say yes, and I'm not saying yes right now, what's the next question? If I say yes.
If you say yes, the next question is, were you insane at the time?
If I say no, what's the next question after that?
If you say no, do you have another song to support that?
Yes, I killed her.
At the time, did you feel insane, crazy? And in no way did you think when you got there that you had any intention that you were going to kill her that night?
When I got there, I didn't plan on anything happening. However, I didn't not plan for nothing to occur.
Okay, I'm just going to tell you this right now.
Please.
If you take the stand with that, they're going to say bullshit.
Let's go back a couple questions.
Okay.
Let's go back a couple questions. No, I did not kill her.
Okay, so that was a lot of fun.
I enjoyed that. That was fun.
Okay. You know, at the beginning, you said, you know, you're scared. It was just such a great gift. Because that's what it looked like. And then you were, I was like, okay, I thought at first we might have been in prison together.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
That's what I thought at first, too. At first, I thought we were in a holding cell together.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, one of the things I like to do is just kind of look at my team partner and see how they're, especially in this game, too, whatever your body posture is, what it says. So for me, I was like, oh, he looks, I think you crossed your arms, like, okay, there's a tension there. So I just said, I'm giving you that tension, was kind of what I took.
Right.
So that came from your
And
your
I
posture.
Don't know, like, for me, making the choice of, like, being a lawyer, mm-hmm. I mean, it worked out. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But probably when I made that choice, a couple beats later, I'm like, you know, I really should have made the choice that we were in together and mm-hmm. spent more time of discovery. So I think probably I panicked a little and was like, okay, I've got to define what the relationship is mm-hmm. in the first couple of months.
I think that's good, though. I think defining the relationship early is helpful because then it gives us a roadmap to play. I know for me, I was panicky as well because in my mind, I totally killed her. Like, I knew that right away. I'm like, I definitely killed this woman. I don't want to reveal that right away because then there's nowhere to go.
Right.
So trying to find like how to deflect those questions.
But don't you think that gives you a natural tension and natural something
yeah.
to play? It's like you have this secret, mm-hmm. you know, that game of secrets
yes.
where you write down a piece of paper,
mm-hmm.
but you're not going to reveal it until you play it throughout
yeah.
the scene. You're not going to come out and say, I killed somebody.
True.
So it gives you something to play with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And I know being in that particular scene,
sitting in those moments, I didn't feel like it was the moments of tension and silence that we had. I think were great. I think there was, that's something, silence in an improv scene is so great when it works and it's just powerful. And I felt like from the crowd too, I was like, okay, the silence is working, but I do know that at some point I have to move it forward. I was just concerned about how fast to move it forward. But, and also I was racking my brain to think of another musical theater song for if I said no, and I couldn't come up with one.
So you said that you felt that the silence, the audience was with us. Was that just an instinct of yours?
Yeah.
Is there something?
It was an instinct, but also I think silence. We'll start with no laugh. They weren't laughing in the silence, but there was also not a lot of rustling or a lot of like shifting. So that means people
nobody
just
was leaving.
Nobody's like, oh fuck it, would you say something?
Right.
Everyone was watching. So to me, that's a great sign. That means if your audience isn't laughing, but they're also not moving, that means they're paying attention. That means they're giving you all their focus. So I'm like, so in that moment, I felt comfortable. Like, oh, we're in a great place. They're with us on this journey. I wasn't nervous about the silences. I felt very comfortable in the silences.
I loved how you busted me, or your character busted me about the arm thing, because I just pulled that out of my ass. I'm like, you know, that's not really honest.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, you gave me an opportunity to let the character be honest, which I love honesty in him.
Yeah, me too. And I was sitting on a moment, because I wanted to come over to you if you had let me, but I kind of had the feeling you were like, just... Your character was like, stay over there.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, I should have followed that instinct and just gotten up and come to you, because I think that would have had some fun. Because in my back of my head, I was ready to tell you that I was also a massage therapist at one point in my life. So I was going to work out your tension while we talked. I think that would have been a fun discovery as well. But
why did you resist that?
Partially because I felt like it would have been a joke. Mm-hmm. I felt like it would have come off as a joke if I had forced it. And also, another side of it was, this could come out later, because I was watching you going, and I was watching for any opportunity where maybe, like, if you shook your arm or you moved your arm in a way, I could say, oh, the arm is back. Now I can bring that back in. So I kind of just shelved it. I was like, okay, this is an idea. Let me just shelve it. And if an opportunity presents itself, I'll throw it back in. But it didn't, which is okay.
Was there anything you would have done differently besides that in the scene?
I think I'm a big dude. I normally don't play big dudes. I normally play smaller characters. I normally play
more low status.
Low status characters, yeah. So I think I'm glad I didn't do what I almost did, which was I almost put myself in a smaller status. When I improvise with people I don't know, a lot of times I'll be thrown into the higher status just because of size.
Right.
Being a bigger person, it's just like, oh, you're big, I'm going to give you focus. Whereas I like to say, I'm big, I want to play against type as often as I can. I love playing women, I like playing small children. I think there's comedy in that, but also it's fun to play against type. It's a fun juxtaposition for me and the audience and my scene partners.
Well, who really had status in that scene?
It's a good question. I think it traded off a couple of times. I think at the beginning, at the very beginning, I think you had it. But then it shifted to me when I started asking you about the wall, when you were like, are you holding up that wall? And you're like, no, I'm fine. And then I think it shifted there, but then it shifted again when you started asking the questions and you got to the, did you kill her? When I asked you to reword that question, did you kill her? Okay, I'm in trouble now. And I felt like that was another status switch. I thought there was a few good status switches in there.
Yeah. I wish I would have been clear, my character, on what I wanted from you. Like, was he innocent? Did I want to get him off? Or... did I think he did it? Because I think that would have been stronger.
Okay.
I would have had a stronger point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt good in it. I felt like I knew that. I kind of felt like you didn't want to be there with me at all. I felt like this was, you were the public defender. It was like,
yes, that's
hey,
exactly right.
you got to go talk to this guy. Oh, right. Shit, not him.
And he was literally like pushed in.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to go in. I don't want to go in. Get in.
Yeah,
there.
And then he slammed the cell.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, yeah, that was sort of when we put the chairs down. For some reason, as soon as I leaned and put my hand on it, I immediately felt jail for some reason. I just said, okay, I feel like we're in a cell. We're in a holding cell. And then you on the other side had that feeling of being thrown into the pool.
And I had no idea until you defined it. I was like, oh my God. I was so in my head about the game. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what am I going to do with the chair? And he's picking the chair up. I didn't think of that.
And that's one of the things at SAC that we really try to to put out of our advisors' heads and our students' heads is that the games will take care of themselves. Like short form and long form, the similarities are in the scene work. Something I push in my classes and with our ensembles is scene first, game second. The short form handles are funny. And, you know, when someone on the sideline, the game forward reverse is an example that comes to mind. That's where someone says, they basically have a remote control, and they'll say, reverse, and you have to just do what you did backwards. You don't have to speak it backwards, you just go in reverse. That's funny in itself, because that's going to take care of itself. The forward reverse will take care of itself. What won't take care of itself is the good improv underneath it. And it's easy to let the tail wag the dog a lot of times in short form, where the games become, oh, this is funny because if we play this game, this thing will happen and the audience will laugh. And that's great, and that's successful, but it gets better and it gets stronger when you say, okay, the game, we know the game, let's worry about the scene. Who are we? How do we feel about each other? What's going on in our world? Are we really listening, not just with our ears, but with our eyes and our whole body? Are we responding to everything that happens? So when we have a real good scene where we have established characters and a relationship, we have additional levels of funny, and we don't go for the easy jokes that the games allow us. That's something we really try to push, and when you get, kind of put that out of your head, the rules of the game, it takes care of itself. It's all about the relationship.
Okay, we're going to have some questions and answers from the audience.
Cool.
We're going to ask you some questions.
Sure.
So if you've got a question, put your hand up, and we'll see if we can get to some questions. Who's got a question? Right here.
Yeah, I have to ask, what was the gig at Disney?
The gig at Disney?
Your gig at Disney.
My gig at Disney, it's called, I'm trying to think of how to word this correctly, legally. I work very closely with Monsters at the Monsters, Inc. Laugh Language.
Yes. How did you know it?
That is my dream job.
Oh, really?
it's a job for an improviser to go down there, and there's not many jobs just for an improviser now that Downtown Disney has closed Pleasure Island.
There's a few.
But that one, I always go, I'm a Disney nut, I always go there and I'm like, this is the perfect job. Motion cap monster improv.
There's a loose scripting, but a lot of you listen to the audience and you react, and you really can have some dynamite moments with an audience member. It's a lot of fun.
Can you explain real quick what it is exactly?
Sure. I can explain it in a way without giving away any insider trading or insider secrets. The show itself is you go into a theater, and in the theater, you're looking at a giant screen. And on that screen, that is the stage where the monsters come out, and they talk to you. So as an audience member, you're looking at it thinking, oh, this is a movie. But it's not. It's a live character. They're called living characters. It's a live character that comes out on stage, and it talks to you, and it interacts with you, and it moves around the space freely.
But if I was in the audience, I would think it was a movie, right?
Yeah. And that's what happens. A lot of audience members think they're watching a movie when they get into the theater.
A movie that's now talking to me.
Yeah, and the movie's saying, hey, you with the blue shirt and the glasses, why are you sleeping? You know, we call out a lot of people for sleeping in the theater because it's very hot. and we have air conditioning. It's completely interactive. So it's fun to see people realize that moment where they go, oh, this isn't a movie. This is actually happening right now.
That sounds really cool.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And being a part of it, the early stages and now 9 years later still doing it, it's still rewarding every day.
Great, let's take another question. Way back there.
Yeah, in places like Chicago where there's so many different teams, so many different schools, do you find that it's like really super competitive or is it more collaborative and that schools support teams from other schools and that kind of thing?
I got to talk into the podcast. So you for the podcast so people can hear this, the question is that in Chicago, because there's so many schools, is it competitive? Was that your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
When I was there, it didn't have a competitive feeling to it. I went through the Improv Olympic, the IO Training Center, and there were performers on teams that were playing at Second City that were also playing at a place called the Playground that would come up from the Annoyance. So there was definitely a collaborative feel. The theaters themselves didn't really, you wouldn't see, at least when I was there, you know, you wouldn't see Sharna from IO going to Second City. She did. I mean, I'm not saying she wouldn't, but that wasn't something that was frequently happening. But the players themselves were, it was very supportive and collaborative. And there was a lot of independent improv. I'm sure there still is. Groups that form out of classes or just form out of necessity because they want to keep playing. So it was mostly collaborative. It wasn't too competitive.
Great. Great, we got a question right here.
How did you become artistic director of SAC?
Oh,
how did you become artistic director of SAC?
Good question, yes. So a few years ago, our theater, our former artistic director, he was the artistic director, managing director of the theater, he decided to step down. And when he decided to step down, he put five of us. There was a big survey that happened throughout the entire company of SAC, because SAC is a pretty big company as far as the amount of performers we have and everything we do. So he had a survey done, and the results of the survey were that five people specifically were very trusted and very respected amongst the SAC community, and my name was one of those names. So the five of us, it was myself, Chris Dinger, David Charles, Stephen Cadwell, and Greg Yates, were basically told by Dave Russell, who was still the current president of SAC, he said, I'm going to step down, and you guys are the young guys, you run it. You know, you're going to take it over. So for a few months, it was a committee, the five of us.
Was it like Survivor?
It was. I held onto the bars long enough.
Right.
It was a committee. We would just kind of get together and decide the things we wanted to do. And then finally, we got to a point where we had to decide, okay, we have to assign these roles. And Dave Russell, who was wonderful, he was doing managing and artistic at the same time. And that's a real hard thing to do, because those two positions need to be, they need to talk to each other. And having the same person do it is very difficult, because those positions will argue, because one's about money and one's about the art. So we decided that Chris Dinger, would become the managing director of SAC, and the other members decided that I would become the artistic director. So that's kind of how it came about.
What's the hardest part of being an artistic director?
Separating the line between professional and personal, because I was a performer with everyone first. And I'm friends with all of these people. You know, we've grown very close. So knowing, the hardest part for me is turning off that time where it's, I'm not talking to my friends, I'm talking to my company.
Now, how is that for a guy who feels responsible for everything?
Horrible. Horrible.
I mean, you are just flop sweat and anxiety.
I've been flop sweating this whole podcast.
I know.
I sweat all the time. But it was hard. It's very hard. But you just have to do it. And that was something I'm still learning. I'm not perfect by any means, and every decision I make is a learning experience. Every experience we have at the theater, I'm learning from, and I'm always trying to ask my peers and my performers at times, like, what can I do more for you? And everyone's very honest and forthcoming, and which is helpful. But the hardest part is just that, dividing that line.
Is there fear, like, because I think anyone who becomes authority, mm-hmm. they're going to take shit, even from people that were your friends. Have you felt that a little?
It's happened a little, yeah. But
behind your back?
Probably.
Okay.
but the decisions I've made, I am confident that they were 100% correct.
Have you made any mistakes?
Yes.
Tell me more.
Lots. What mistakes I've made? I would say that it's more of a general kind of overview. I should be stricter with casting. Sometimes I let that lapse, and I think that's something that happens, unfortunately, in a lot of improv theaters, is because it's usually friends coming together who like each other and want to play together, but there's going to be times where there are people or players or personalities that don't either aren't matching or can be destructive or can be distracting, and our instinct is to, well, it'll work itself out. And I've gone to that instinct a few times. Not all the time. Sometimes I've made the decisions I've had to make. But I think...
Or you have to say, hey, look.
Yeah, this is the line.
It's not working for
you. And I think that's a decision that I shy away from, because when I do it, I carry it. Because I feel the pain of the person that I've had to do it to.
Right.
I feel that pain, and I hold on to it. And I'm like, oh, I got to let that go. But I'd say that's probably... one of the mistakes I've made. I'm sure I've made others.
We have another question.
When you talked about doing good improv underneath either short form or long form, in your scene creation, what school of thought do you look for when you come in to create a scene with your partner? Do you immediately worry about your partner and support them, and then you'll figure yourself out? Do you worry about yourself, and then your partner worries about themselves, or do you focus on game, and then you guys figure it out, or something else?
Great question. How do you approach it when you come to a scene?
It varies. It's varied a lot over time, but right now, what I like to do is a two-prong approach. I come into a scene, I decide something for myself right away, because it took me a while to fully understand, and I feel like that's most of, and you can probably answer this, that feels like that's more of the annoyance style, is kind of take care of yourself.
Well, so, right? so, get, so, so the two-pronged system is one, what was the decision you made?
I take care of myself. I give myself something, whether it be...
What did you give yourself in that scene?
In that scene, I gave myself... I decided to play my size. I was like, I'm going to play big and intimidating.
Okay.
And then I looked at my partner and looked at you and said, okay, what I'm getting off of him is intimidating, which could be because I made this choice, maybe not, but that's what I got. So now that's how I go forward. I definitely make a decision for myself, and then I look at my scene partner and say, what am I getting from my scene partner? That's
great.
Kind of how it goes.
Right here.
You talked a bit about how you started in a college group and you moved onwards through that. Do you have any advice for some people who would like to transition from playing improv in college to maybe taking it more seriously down the road?
What advice would you give someone from who's been in college, who's doing improv in college, and now they want to take it more seriously?
Sure. Don't discount college improv. I think it's very valuable. You're getting to perform, you know, and you're getting experience in front of an audience. So that's, I'd say, you know, college improv is very valuable. I think to take that next step and take it more seriously, I would say if you can't move to a city like Chicago, find time to go do the intensives and keep immersing yourself in it. Read the books and put it into practice. Getting a group of friends together, even if you're not performing in front of an audience for a while, but just saying, okay, I read this exercise and this exercise, I just want to work on this. Or I know that I want to work on characters, I want to work on relationships, I want to work on responding, you know, and having a group of people you work with that. I'd say just keep getting up and keep practicing.
We got to wrap this up. This has just been great. And we end each podcast with the same question. What one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
Know that wherever you are in your process is where you're supposed to be. And don't beat yourself up for not having something that you think you should have. Just know where you are and say, this is where I am, and I'm going to make the best of it.
Mike Carr, Artistic Director at SAC in Orlando, Florida, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the Can. I believe it's 165 or 166. I'm not sure. I'm not good with numbers. I don't really pay attention to them. I was never good at math, so you're gonna have to double check my math is what you're gonna have to do. I want to thank our guest Mike Carr, and I loved improvising with him. I thought he was just a great improviser, and teaching me that game, that short form game called Chairs, I believe is the name. It was just so much fun. I also would like to thank Nicholas Riggs at the Tampa Improv Festival for bringing us down, as well as SAC Comedy Lab in Orlando. I taught a workshop on Saturday in Orlando for the SAC Comedy Lab, and then I did the Improv Nerd that night, and then a workshop for the Tampa Improv Festival, and they coordinated it together so to bring me down there. So I want to thank them both for bringing me down there. I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd blog, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. You'll find t-shirts and books and all sorts of fun things, which is great fun gift ideas. We're also taking over social media. I don't know if you heard this or not, but we're doing it very slowly. We have a Facebook page, so like Improv Nerd. It really helps with my low self-esteem. And then you can follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. And then, of course, we have a wonderful YouTube channel, and we have little clips from the actual live performances, and that's Improv Nerd Podcast. We're lucky enough to be part of a podcast collective called Feral Audio, so check out all their great podcasts at feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank both our sponsors today, Ad Lib Theater in Winter Park, Florida. Check them out at adlibcomedy.com. And then, of course, the Dallas Comedy Festival. And for more information, go to dallascomedyfestival.com. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk. Don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein. and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I'd love having you